No shirt, no shoes, no Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. The Admiral Horatio Lord Nelson of Medicare Podcasts. From time to time, he wanders off the reservation, Medicare expert Doug Jones.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Drew McMillan, for that wonderful introduction. It's always a pleasure to hear your voice, and you sound a lot more chipper now that little Nora has come along to live with you and Magda. That's your new daughter, in case you've forgotten. It's always a pleasure to hear Drew, consummate Canadian entertainer, introduce one of our episodes of Medicare for the Lazy Man podcast. This is a podcast that seeks to help people enter the world of Medicare and leave behind the world of Obamacare or whatever they've been involved in up till now. And we are hoping to help that process along by making it painless, perhaps a little bit entertaining, and profitable for me. Yours truly, Douglas B. Jones, your Medicare expert. This is all based on my book that I rewrite every year, Medicare for the Lazy Man, Simplest and Easiest Guide Ever. The current edition has a big red 2021 on the cover, so that's the one you're looking for when you go to Amazon. The paperback is priced at thrifty $8 for all of you savers out there, and that's because we managed to cheapen it up by removing all of the color from the inside of the book. Amazon charges a ton of money per copy if you have color illustrations. And so I said, let's make all the illustrations black and white. Now, if you're the kind of person that likes color and you insist upon color, you could go over to barnesandnoble.com. The book is on sale there with full color illustrations for not much more than the $8 that Amazon is selling it for. Now, the other way to do it is to get a Kindle version or an ebook from Amazon for the price of about $3.80. And someday soon, as Randy and I discuss almost every episode, the Audible book will be coming. It may be another month. It may be a couple of weeks. It may be 2 years from now. We don't know. But we are sitting here hopeful, and we have a positive attitude that someday they'll get their audio review finished. They've only had it since January 20th. And frankly, I'm sure they're going word by word, syllable by syllable, to see if I've put anything objectionable into that book. They're not going to find anything that's not in the print version. And so far, nobody has tried to cancel me when it comes to the print version. So I'm pretty sure the Audible version is going to be quite acceptable to anybody who listens to it. So what happens here? Well, first thing we do is we bring up the mic on my favorite dial twister. That would be Randy Carson. Randy, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Doug. How are you up there in your, your castle, or is your castle of solitude? Please.
It's a glorified hotel room. I've called it the Fortress of Solitude.
Of Solitude. Yes, yes. But in reality, telling you, that's a pretty good looking hotel room you got there.
Well, when I was given a green light to come to Arizona to buy something, because all we did was come to Arizona and spend money on hotel rooms, I said, okay, I want to get a very inexpensive glorified hotel room. This is back in 2004. And so in 2004, I was given carte blanche to go find a piece of property. And I did my best to keep it cheap, but I failed miserably and wound up spending three times as much money as I'd wanted to. But it turns out to have paid off. The real estate values here are going sky high. In fact, every time somebody puts a house in my neighborhood up for sale, there's a bidding war on it. There's a feeding frenzy. Yeah. A guy with my floor plan, probably 100 yards down, just sold his. He listed it for $440, and it sold for $480 the next day. And my place is much nicer than his, so I expect to be over five at some point.
Well, that's a good piece of news, Doug. I bet you're glad you stepped outside the box to buy that nice house.
Well, I am now. At the time, I was pinching pennies, and my fingers hurt from all the penny pinching I was doing, but it turns out to have paid off. So I have no complaints. Plus, I get a nice place to hang out in Arizona. Anytime I want to, I can just step outside and look at 360-degree mountain views all around the house. And plus, every time I'm out there staring at the mountains, I'm also I'm multitasking. I'm making vitamin D. I'm like a vitamin D factory.
I thought maybe there would be one more task in there.
Oh, tell me what that might be. Like I need more tasks.
Absorbing liquid out of an aluminum can.
I do that frequently. It's not something I talk about in the morning because people get the wrong idea. But yes, that's an important part of daily life here in Arizona, and especially in Cave Creek. It's a popular activity, and we gather together. It's not a soul activity. You know, it's not the kind of thing where you go and hide to practice it. You go out in the open and join your friends and neighbors in that consumption of alcohol.
Yes.
In the cans.
I totally get it. Now, as you know, I'm a Guinness drinker.
I've seen that happen, yes.
Are you still your primary brew of choice is Miller straight up?
Miller High Life or MGD, either of those two is just fine with me. On the other hand, if the container does not say light on it, and if it's some kind of domestic, it's going to be acceptable. And if it is not domestic, but it doesn't say light, then that's going to be acceptable too. And if it says Amstel Light, I will forgive the word light being on the container because that's pretty tasty stuff. And then down at the bottom of the barrel, if all somebody has to offer is a light beer, I'll reluctantly take it and I probably won't complain too much. I just don't like to encourage the breweries to make light beer. I mean, just take regular beer and then add water to it. That seems like
sacrilege. Yeah, that's really all they do is, oh, let's get a really, you know, a little bit stronger flavored beer than we would normally brew, and let's add some water to it until the calorie and the alcohol content go down.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan, and I don't want to encourage that sort of thing to keep going on. So I'm not going to spend any money on a light beer unless that's the only choice. And then, I'll close my eyes, hold my nose, and go ahead and do that.
If they ever come up with a Guinness Light, you can personally, and additionally to that, Doug, if you ever hear about me drinking one,
oh boy,
you have my personal permission to come down and hit me in the head because you know that I will have lost my mind.
Well, at that point, I assume there would be other clues that will have preceded that horrible activity. And so it might come so far as putting a bullet in your brain if I think there's no recourse, but I don't want to have to do that.
If there's no saving me, just go for it. Hey, I've got one other thing from last episode.
Oh, you did have some hanging chads.
I got a hanging chad, and at your request and suggestion, which worked out well, I took a note.
Please share that note with us.
The hanging chad is that I am going to recount an episode where our next door neighbor, which name shall remain off record, was out of town, and the next door neighbor's sister was in watching their kids. Now, about 9 o'clock at night, one of the children comes over and bangs on the door and said, "Do you have an aspirin?" "By golly, we do. How many would you like?" Oh, he didn't know that part because he's only just a little guy.
Okay.
So we gave him two aspirin. Well, first of all, we asked him what he needed him for, and he said, I need them for my aunt. Okay, well, let's give you two aspirin and let's call it good. So then next night, same deal, aspirin. Okay, so we inquire a little bit more. We ultimately found out that the aunt they didn't have any aspirin in the house, and she wouldn't drive to the local grocery store or CVS or anything else because she had a phobia about only turning left.
Oh, boy.
And do you know how many times it took me to figure that? I just took it on as a challenge.
Now, does this mean that she likes to turn left or she doesn't like to turn left?
She will only turn left. She won't turn right. So do you know how many times it took me to figure out a left-hand turn only route to CVS?
Well, I'm guessing it was quite a few times.
Yes.
Would that be correct?
Yes, quite a few times, because I took it on as a mental challenge, because I did. I mean, I know it's always possible. It's always possible. But I just thought, my God, she might have to drive 50 miles to get this done.
Okay, well, let me ask you a couple of questions here. First of all, did you plot this out on paper, or did you actually get in one of your cars and
No, I drove. I drove it.
Okay. Second question. Does this have anything to do with her political proclivities at all?
I think she was severely left-leaning, but okay, to the point that she only turned left.
Oh, well, there you go. Now, there are probably others out there like that, but I've never run into one. And I think I told you when I lived in Tucson, I didn't like left turns because it was definitely difficult and dangerous to do that. So I was a right turner.
A right turner. So let me ask you this then, Doug. Have you ever driven or spent any significant time riding with anybody in Detroit?
I have spent time driving around in the Detroit area, going through mostly, and I did take one trip where we stayed there for 3 or 4 days. So, but that was in the suburban area. Haven't spent much time driving through downtown Detroit, mostly because I'm a chicken.
Well, they have this thing. I don't know what you call this thing, but when you come up to an intersection of, you know, street A and street B, and it's a 90 degree intersection, and you want to turn left, you can't do it. You have to go across the intersection in the left-hand lane, stay in the left-hand lane, and then there's a little dipsy-doodle road through the median that you have to turn left onto and then scoot over to the right-hand lane so you can ultimately turn right on the street that you wanted to turn left on.
Okay, that sounds pretty wacky. It sounds like what I see along Interstate 10 in El Paso. When you take an exit ramp from Interstate 10 and you want to go to some place that's adjacent to the interstate, it's a screwy method of getting across the interstate underneath it or whatever, and or even turning right. Yeah, I just remember being confused the first couple of times I tried to get to a restaurant in El Paso. So
yeah,
that might be the same kind of thing.
Did you see any of those poor people that never could hone in on the restaurant that are just skeletons sitting along the side of the road?
Yes, with spider webs, draping off of them.
Out of gas, trying to get to, what would it be, Wendy's, or what were they trying to hit?
Well, I was trying to get to, the first time this ever happened to me, I was trying to get to Outback Steakhouse.
Oh, yeah.
I sailed right past it, and I said, that's where we'll stop for dinner, and couldn't get to it to save my soul. It took quite some maneuvering, took some time.
I know. I totally get it. Well, you know something? I'm going to have to pull out my work hammer here.
All right.
Because we need to do some Medicare.
Someday I'm going to be asking you if that visitor next door is still there or if she managed to leave. But you can finish that story.
Took her 3 weeks to get out of here, but yeah, she left.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. Okay, so here's the deal. I have an article here that I highlighted in yellow that I made some notes on. And then I think I accidentally read the headline during an episode a while back when I wasn't going to read this article. And you burst out laughing. And I said, well, let's not address this now, and because I hadn't planned on doing that. And in the subsequent months, maybe years, since I originally had the thought, I have forgotten all about it. So I'm going to be reading this. It'll be new to me, just like it's new to everybody else. That this is an article I ran across entitled "Choosing the Wrong Health Insurance Could Kill You." And it's a cheery little piece that is guaranteed to put a smile on everyone's face.
That sounds like something out of Reader's Digest, Doug. They're so positive all the time.
Oh, yeah, it is kind of short, so it's it could have come from Reader's Digest. This is from a guy who's connected with the Yale School of Medicine. Took me a while to figure that out. It says Yale SOM's Jason Abluck and his co-authors. So anyway, by examining what happens to outcomes when Medicare Advantage beneficiaries switch from one privately managed health insurance plan to another, these guys calculated that the plans appreciably influence survival rates of their enrollees. Well, Randy and I have been kind of saying that some plans are even worse than average, and that you are possibly served poorly by some of these Medicare Advantage plans that refuse to give you permission to go see specialists and to have treatments that may require special permission. They seem to like to turn people down and deny them permission to pay for that sort of thing. And then what we discovered was in one study, they eventually will cave in very quickly if you file an appeal. But by then, it may be too late. And also a very small minority of participants tend to go through the jump through the hoops of filing an appeal. So they don't benefit from treatment by specialists. And it becomes a big problem for some people. So this article goes on to say, shutting down the plans with the highest mortality rates could save thousands of lives per year. And this is an article written last September. Choosing a health insurance plan is among the most important consumer decisions we make, and for many of us, among the most bewildering. Do you pick a plan with the lowest out-of-pocket cost, or the one that allows you to see primary care physicians you trust? Do you care more about prescription drug benefits or mental health coverage? One thing that doesn't end up on most pro or con lists is whether a particular plan is likely to prolong your life. But new research co-authored by this guy, this Yale School of Medicine's Jason Abluck, shows that insurance plans appreciably influence the survival rates of their enrollees. Insurance companies have way too little incentive to invest in things that will actually make people healthier. Despite the variation in mortality effects, consumers aren't flocking to the plans most likely to benefit their health. Not necessarily because they don't care, but because they aren't well informed about how plans affect health outcomes, the researchers found. To Abluck, the guy who wrote the article, the research reveals not only, well, he didn't write the article, he did the research upon which the article is based. The research revealed to him not only a policy failure to guide consumers toward the best choices, but also a fundamental breakdown to current private insurance markets. They have way too little incentive to invest in things that will actually make people healthier. So the study is entitled Mortality Effects and Choice Across Private Health Insurance Plans. If you plug that into a search engine, that's probably going to allow you to come up with the study and the results of the study. Studying how insurance plans affect mortality has long vexed policymakers and economists. It's hard to disentangle the people from the plan. If you see that a medical condition, or if you see that a plan has a low mortality rate, it might just be that younger, healthier non-smokers with fewer medical conditions choose that plan. Researchers can control for some of those factors, such as age, but others, such as diet, exercise, stress, those resist statistical analysis. To understand health plans' mortality effects, this Abluck and his co-authors focused on the Medicare Advantage market, which covers about a third of all Medicare beneficiaries and allows them to pick from a variety of privately managed plans subsidized by the government. Now, remember how Medicare Advantage plans work. The government writes a check, hands it to the insurance company. The insurance company, within strict parameters, has to devise a plan and then attract participants. And that will be the Medicare Advantage plan that is subsidized by the government. That's what we wind up with Medicare Advantage. But each of them has a different set of rules and benefits, and they, you know, promote them differently in order to attract enough participants to have a viable medical plan, a freestanding medical plan. So participants have lots of options. Then they refer to back in 2010, 33 different Medicare Advantage plans operated in a typical U.S. county. I don't know why they picked a 10-year-old statistic here, but the researchers' data included more than 15 million Medicare Advantage enrollees in the plans offered to them between 2006 and 2011. Maybe it took 10 years for them to crunch the numbers after the study was over. With the wealth of choices on Medicare Advantage market comes a large variation in mortality rates, the researchers discovered. Within the same county, even... Do they know I'm only halfway through?
Let me tell them.
Yeah, let me tell them. Please do. So anyway, within
I've lost track of my technology here. Hold on.
I always appreciate them chiming in when we have boring, dull content, but this is exciting stuff. This is not reading mailbag content. Anyway, within the same county, even controlling for basic demographic factors, plans mortality rates were super different. That's in quotes, super different. There are some plans where 2% of the people die in a given year, and some plans where 8% of the people die. Of course, this raises the question, is that because those plans enroll healthier people or because those plans are actually making people healthier? The ideal way to answer this question would be to randomly assign people in different Medicare Advantage plans. But since that's not possible, this researcher and his co-authors looked for a creative way to approximate a randomized controlled trial. Plan terminations, they realized, offer just such an opportunity. Sometimes Medicare Advantage plans are terminated, forcing enrollees to pick a new option, creating a kind of experiment. Oh boy. So how do you Medicare Advantage people enjoy being experimented upon? Of particular interest to the researchers was the fate of people forced to leave plans with especially low and especially high mortality rates. These individuals tended to end up in plans with more middle-of-the-road mortality rates. If the terminated plans had low mortality rates because they happened to have healthy enrollees, you'd expect to see those individuals' mortality rates stay the same when they moved into a new plan. But if the plans themselves were affecting the health outcomes, then you would expect to see mortality rates change as patients switched plans. And that's exactly what this Abluck and his co-authors discovered. If people are reassigned from a good plan to an average plan, they get much sicker. If they are reassigned from a bad plan, they get much healthier. So why aren't consumers all opting for the most life-prolonging plans? Well, while mortality rates aren't publicly available, there is other information to guide consumers in their choices, most notably star ratings from the CMS. That's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. CMS is a government department that doesn't know how to spell its own acronym. It should be CMMS, but it winds up that they decided to use CMS. I can't explain it. Anyway, the star ratings that they insist upon are a measure of quality you might expect would correlate with mortality. But it turns out that CMS star ratings, which are calculated based on factors including customer satisfaction, have absolutely zero relationship to mortality rates. Whether a plan has 5 stars or 2 tells you nothing about whether that plan is likely to make you live longer. Abluck says that, in other words, one of the few pieces of information consumers have when making their choice does not help them select plans with low mortality rates. In fact, the researchers found only one easily accessible piece of information that corresponded with plan mortality rates: price. Plans with higher premiums and more generous prescription drug coverage do appear to have better outcomes, though most of the variation in whether plans extend your life is not explained by those factors. So I guess they're saying it's good to have those, but it's not explaining 100% of the difference. Ultimately, it's not surprising that Medicare Advantage participants aren't picking the best plans. They don't have the information they need. As a result, they are way, way less sensitive to mortality effects than they would be if they fully understood the differences across those plans. To Ebluck, the research suggests several ways to make Medicare Advantage work better for Americans. For example, regulators could simply remove the plans with the highest mortality rates from the market. Eliminating the worst 5% of plans, researchers estimate, could save around 10,000 elderly lives a year. The government could also require plans to provide life insurance, creating a strong financial incentive to meaningfully improve the health of enrollees. And CMS could change how it calculates star ratings to include mortality rates. This is important, not just because it would better inform consumers, but also because star ratings affect the rate at which plans are reimbursed by the government. Let's reimburse plans based on what we actually care about, he says, which is whether they make people live longer. So that would be the content of the article entitled "Choosing the Wrong Health Insurance Could Kill You." and that's all about Medicare Advantage plans. So I don't know. Was that pretty exciting stuff for you, Randy?
I thought it was very interesting. So they're surmising that a Medicare disadvantage plan that has a higher mortality rate is causing that based on the environmental aspects of the plan. In other words, maybe the doctor's network they're offering, maybe the drug plan they're offering, maybe, you know, how reluctant they are to approve, you know, extraordinary services, those kind of things. So are they actually saying that a plan with a higher mortality rate is being caused by that plan?
Excuse me, had to cough there. My mortality was checking in. Hey, Doug, you ready to go yet? No, I'm not. Here's what I took from that. They identified a few things that they thought were correlated with better mortality rates, such as a plan with a better or a more broad coverage for prescription drugs, and a plan yeah. with higher premium, meaning they don't try to restrict access to the doctors that are specialists. Read about studies in which the government caught these plans restricting unfairly access to specialists, refusing to pay for an appointment with a specialist. So I would think that a plan that doesn't do that sort of thing would have a better mortality rate overall.
And, you know, help me remember, Doug, on that other study that you presented on the podcast, wasn't it somewhere on the north side of 80% that got rejected the first time out?
I think they rejected everybody. The plans that were studied by the director of security for whatever, you know, some government agency, Health and Human Services, I think it was, those plans had rejected all requests or almost all requests. But when the tiny number of participants came back and filed formal appeals, these plans caved immediately and approved their own rejections. They overrode their own rejected participant requests. So what happened was 1% of the people filled out appeals. 99% of the people that were rejected, basically, you know, they just went away. So it was
and died, apparently.
Right. They might have they might have had runny noses and they just bought another box of Kleenex. Or back pain. It could have been people with pain and they wound up living with the pain. They might have solved it by paying out of their own pocket for medical treatment from a specialist that they wanted to see. And there was a figure of about 75%. I believe the 75% figure had to do with once the people appealed. Only 1% of the people appealed. Of those, 75% were then granted the permission to go see the specialist or have the treatment that they were seeking. So it was really kind of a scary Big Brother-ish type of thing where the plans were playing with people's, playing roulette, basically, with people's medical treatment.
Well, you know, the other variable that you just prompted me to factor into my head here, because I love statistics. So you said they may have taken care of themselves out of their own pocket. So that would be another variable that they would have to factor in terms of these plans with higher mortality. Was the average Joe citizen on that plan not able to take care of his needs out of his pocket and was depending almost exclusively on the plan?
You're absolutely right. I imagine that people with less ability to pay for rejected treatment out of their own pockets would have a worse outcome, most likely. You know, they're at the mercy of whatever the plan tells them they have to do.
Because the other day, I called, you know, just out of the phone book, a Medicare Disadvantage Plan customer service line.
Mm-hmm. And hey, that sounds like fun. You do that for fun now? Or
I did that for fun. And they answered the phone and said, yes, this is, you know, California West Side, you know, mutually exclusive Advantage Plan customer service. They said, please hold. Then about 10 minutes later, they came back and said, no.
Well, yes, I made several phone calls to a prescription drug plan to a company that also has Medicare Advantage plans that they try to sell. And I don't sell any of those things, but I connected with people in fairly short order, and that surprised me, but they all had the same message for me. This is three different people. The message was, our computers are down. We can't do a thing for you. Could you call back later or tomorrow? Now that's just, you know, poor customer service as far as I'm
concerned. Well, for God's sakes, I mean, all right, keep in mind I came out of banking and the finance industry. You know what would have happened to me if, you know, a customer walked into our bank and said, I would like to withdraw $1,000. And then we said to them, sorry, the computer's down. Come back later.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I can see the negative consequences there.
Yeah. And there's interesting laws around banking that apparently aren't around insurance. But there's an old federal law in the books that says if you have not posted your banking records current for more than, I think at that time it was 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? You're no longer a bank.
Oh, boy. Wow. Well, I know there's all kinds of weird stuff. A friend of mine has been in banking his whole adult career, and I believe he has told me many times about the regulation, the amount of oversight in the banking industry, and how you can't ever take a three-day weekend because the bank cannot be closed. Otherwise, you know, thefts, money that has been siphoned off the top won't be discovered for some period of time, allowing the perpetrator to, you know, get farther away.
Well, there is that. And that's also the reason they make all employees in a bank at least take 2 weeks off consecutively, because they figured that in 2 weeks, they'll have time to figure out if you were game in the system.
Yeah, I had an employee who was apparently getting a little sticky fingered with the cash drawer in our insurance office. And so I talked to my friend. We were playing poker and drinking beer. And I said, look, I got to deal with this broad and I don't know quite how to do it. And he said, well, here's what you do. Slip an extra 20 in the till. And she'll be so surprised that she'll just take it right out of there, stuff it in her pocket and report to you that everything is balanced perfectly as always. And so that's what I did. I totaled out what should have been there. I added a $20 bill. And then I waited for her reaction. And when she brought that drawer back after doing her job, she proudly announced that yep, everything balances again as usual. And of course, the next day I called in the gendarmes and we had her hustled out of there.
Yes. Mabel, would you come speak to me in my office? That's never, and especially if you have the HR lady with you, that's never a good sign.
Yeah. Speaking of good signs, is there a sign flashing that tells us to get the heck out of here? Because I'll bet some of the listeners are wishing that we would.
Well, I really thoroughly enjoyed this episode. There's on when you're talking statistics, you've got me because I'm all ears. But in terms of the audience, thank you so much. I appreciate you sticking with us. We always enjoy having you, and we will look forward to seeing you again next time. You have spent 32 and a half minutes with Doug Jones, the anti-insurance insurance guy and new CEO of MLM Air.
Boy, it gets longer and longer all the time. I swear to God, he's not reading this stuff. He's got it in his head.
I do, and I can go on for much more. But having said that, run to your computer, go to Amazon.com, order the book, order the electronic copy for your Kindle. Wait, I swear we're going to have an audiobook out sometime within the next.
That's the plan. Well, within before the end of 2021, we should have.
Okay. I was going to try to quote, but I can't quote because who knows?
You'd have to quote Nostradamus to get any sort of guess as to when this book is going to be approved. But
that's right.
Anyway, once again, as Randy said, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you next episode.